The Tom Woods Show, episode 2013.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Patrick Newman is back with us. We want to discuss further material in his book, Cronyism, Liberty versus Power in America, 1607 to 1849. We left off around the Louisiana Purchase last time. So pick up there. I have a couple topics I want to hone in on in particular. But Patrick, not only welcome to the show, but congratulations on having a photo of Rob Schneider reading your book circulating on Twitter.
Thank you. Yeah, it was certainly an honor. I was very pleasantly surprised by that. And yeah, it's pretty cool. I won't lie. So it's something I take in stride. I guess that's when you know you've made it in the history market. When Deuce Bigelow and the Hot Chick, they're reading your book. That's when I guess you know you've made it.
Yeah, indeed. I haven't reached that level. I've had him on the show. I haven't quite reached that level. We can't all be Patrick Newman. You know, there's only one. There's only one Patrick Newman.
You're too kind.
All right, let's talk about, there are a couple things in 19th century economic history that are treated absolutely cartoonishly in the textbooks. So one of them is internal improvements, and the other one is money and banking. Now, typically money and banking is not even covered in the textbook. I mean, in high school, there's almost nothing that you're going to read about the monetary system or systems in the U.S. in the early to mid-19th century. You're just not going to read anything about it. You'll read a little something maybe about the bank war against the Second Bank of the United States by Andrew Jackson. But even that will generally be portrayed as a political rather than an economic issue. You know, Andrew Jackson was a stupid hick who didn't understand banking, and he was fearful of concentrations of power. They'll never actually get into the economics of it. Number one, because they don't want to give you any ideas, but secondly, because they don't know the economics of it. But you do, so that's why I want to talk about this stuff. As a matter of fact, one of the times I had you on long before this book came out was to discuss a paper you had written that's beyond the scope of this book because it involved 1873, but you did a study, and you've been interested in panics and economic downturns in the U.S. before we had the Federal Reserve and looking into what the causes and consequences of them were. So I know this is a topic that's of interest to you. So why don't we start, given that we talked Louisiana Purchase, so to very, very early 19th century. So we had gotten into the 19th century just barely. Let's fast forward up to the Panic of 1819. Of course, Murray Rothbard wrote that great book, The Panic of 1819, on that subject. And explain for a layman what was going on there and what conclusions we can draw.
Sure. So the Panic of 1819 was really the nation's first business cycle or widespread business cycle. We had the Panic of 1797, which was caused by the Bank of the United States, or at least the first Bank of the United States, credit expansion, you know, classic Austrian business cycle, and so on. The Panic of 1819 was really this blown up on a much larger scale. It's a very important downturn that I think often gets overlooked, especially because it's the same year as the Missouri crisis and all of that. But it really was the much more significant event from the perspective of your average American. And it really did set the stage for a future political battles over the next 10, 20 years. This was a panic that was caused by the newly created Second Bank of the United States, which was given a federal charter in 1816. It expanded credit tremendously, created a real estate boom out in the West, a lot of other projects, these classic higher order investments that Austrians talk about, et cetera. And the bank was trying to do this to, one, lend money to state banks so they could resume specie payments after the War of 1812. But of course, by lending them money, the Bank of the United States, Second Bank of the United States, was losing its own specie reserves. So at the end of 1818, it engaged in a tremendous contraction. And this contraction, the sharp deflation, popped the bubble. It led to the Panic of 1819. Unlike later business cycle crises, there wasn't a traditional stock market crash or sudden bank failures or run on the banks, but it's still called the Panic of 1819. It's this downturn. And it was really caused by the Second Bank of the United States, which, on top of engaging in massive monetary easing, also engaged in various individuals there, engaged in a lot of fraudulent behavior and so on. And this downturn really reinvigorated the hard money movement in the United States. A lot of people said, wait a second, fractional reserve banking, central banking, it's leading to a lot of problems. There are various economists who are talking about this, et cetera. And that, in turn, this is something Rothbard discussed in his dissertation, led to the Jacksonian hard money movement. Guys like Andrew Jackson, Martin Van Buren, Thomas Hart, aka Old Bullion Benton, James K. Polk, et cetera, or a lot of these guys, they got their anti-central bank, pro-gold standard, pro-hard money orientation as a result of this downturn.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I found most interesting. Now, I don't remember if it was in Rothbard's book or not. Must have been. Quoting people who, after having observed this particular downturn, realized the connection between the monetary instability and, you know, the lack of a fully hard money system, the need for a fully hard money system. And isn't that interesting, too, that there are people who actually observe the world and then say, maybe I should draw conclusions from this. You know, it's hard to believe that a couple hundred years ago, people did do that. They would say, well, maybe given in light of what's been going on, I should adjust the way I think. I think also it's not very well known to people just how pro-gold and anti-fiat people like Thomas Jefferson were, because nobody talks about that. Nobody talks about what these people's opinions on subjects like that were. But I, for one, think that's a very interesting and important topic. Why would their opinions on free speech be interesting, but their opinions on money not be interesting? He asks rhetorically.
Exactly. A lot of people, traditional history, even you learn in the classic, public school textbooks, et cetera, they don't really talk about monetary reform. If anything, they're always going to criticize guys like Jefferson. Oh, he's so ignorant. He wanted the government to only deal in hard money. Jefferson had sort of devised a rudimentary independent treasury plan where the government would only accept specie in its payments, and then it would only spend gold and silver in its various expenditures. And this was to totally divorce the government, the federal government, at least, from the banking system, which is something that Rothbard was a fan of, the independent treasury. It was a system that worked very good. It was enacted under the Van Buren and then later the Polk administration. And yeah, there were a lot of people. And Rothbard, I did get this from Rothbard. I do cite other economists who have written on this subject. But one of my favorite quotes actually from Andrew Jackson that Rothbard does reference in his Panic of 1819 is that when there was a proposal to basically push for a government loan office in Tennessee that could issue paper money, Andrew Jackson sent a memorial to the state legislature, and this memorial cited judicious political economists. And these economists had demonstrated, quote, the large emissions of paper from the banks by which the country was inundated have been the most prominent causes of those distresses of which we at present complain, which from the perspective of modern Austrian theory, so yes, that's correct. That's correct. As these banks were over-issuing, they created this bubble. And then in order to save themselves, they had to pop the bubble, which caused a lot of distress for your average person. And this really did influence Jackson and many of his supporters. And this was a good influence, I'd say, because after the War of 1812, that hard money sentiment in the country had died down, but the Panic of 1819 reinvigorated it.
Well, as long as we're talking about banking, let's then move ahead to Andrew Jackson. So now we're talking about Jackson elected in 1828, and he's against the Second Bank of the U.S., whose charter wasn't set to expire until, I think, I haven't looked at this in a long time, but I think 1836, but he wanted to take it on early, so toward the end of his first term. And the way historians write it, he was obsessed with the bank, and there's that scene where he's feeling ill, and he says to Van Buren, the bank is trying to kill me, and this whole thing. It is true that he had some concerns about the bank that were other than economic. He did have a constitutional concern, the same sort that Jefferson had had about the first bank. And no doubt he did think that this type of concentration of wealth, artificial concentration, could lead to political corruption. But the Jacksonians as a group, you can find an awful lot of them who had a fairly sophisticated understanding of money and banking, and even a kind of proto-Austrian understanding of the business cycle and how, an unstable money leads to economic fluctuations that hurt a lot of people.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The Jacksonians They were against corporate bank charters. They recognized they caused inefficiency. They also led to business cycles. You started to see these theorists, they were influenced by the British currency school, who also influenced Ludwig von Mises and the development of his own business cycle. They recognized that banks with various privileges from the government, they're going to engage in too much credit expansion, and that will lead to all sorts of distortions in production and so on. And in Jackson and his supporters, they recognized this, which is why they were against the bank. They also attacked, you know, the monopoly charter that the bank had. Congress wouldn't charter another bank. It had a monopoly on federal deposits, or at least the government stored most of its money at the bank. They were irked at its immunity from state taxes, which is an interesting dynamic we could get into. But Jackson was against the bank because it had a lot of, it was crony. It had a lot of privileges. And of course, it would use these privileges to corrupt politicians, businesses, and newspapers by giving them or not giving them favorable loans. And this is a problem. And I think a lot of times, undeniably, Jackson, there were some personal issues between him and Biddle, especially building up to the famous Biddle pushes for the early recharter. But Jackson and his supporters, they were genuinely against the bank, against the central bank. Now, they did struggle with precisely how to reform it. And sometimes their proposals did veer on what looked like their own central bank, just run by the right people. But they did settle upon the independent treasury, that old Jeffersonian plan we had previously discussed. And this sort of difficulty with reform, this was something that also affected the British currency school. So this wasn't something just only the Jacksonians had to deal with. This was an interesting problem that even today we could face a similar problem of reform. It's you're against the government intervention, but what's the exact path to the free market? It's an important question that especially these guys struggled with because they actually had the chance to bring about a quasi-free market with their reforms. But the Jacksonian struggle against the bank is a really key part in American history.
Well, once the bank's charter does not get renewed, then the question becomes, what happens next? What replaces the National Bank? First of all, what functions is it performing that might need to be replaced? Because I think the way I understand it is that under Martin Van Buren, who succeeded Jackson, we wound up getting pretty much the most laissez-faire monetary system we've ever had in American history, and it actually worked extremely well. But so what happens after there's no National Bank?
Well, so when Jackson vetoes the recharter in 1832, of course, this is the famous recharter right before the election that Henry Clay was pushing for Nicholas Biddle to go for the two-point conversion, so to speak, by basically saying, well, if Jackson vetoes the bank, he'll lose the election, or if Jackson doesn't veto the recharter, he'll look very weak, and this will allow me to win, me, Henry Clay, the presidential election of 1832. Of course, Jackson vetoes it, and he triumphantly wins. And then the next step is, okay, the bank's charter is going to basically, you know, be eliminated over the next couple of years. What to do next? There were the proposals for the independent treasury plan around this time period, but unfortunately, the Jacksonians, they decided to at least start with the pet bank solution, which is saying, okay, the bank is going to lose its charter, but we still are keeping all of our money in the bank, right? The government, the treasury is keeping all of its money at the bank. So we need to take the money out of the bank and let's put it into various pet banks. So these state banks that will now accept the government's money. The issue with that is it is better than having a central bank, but it does sort of spread the corruption around, so to speak, where now these state banks are benefiting from the government's privilege of having the government's money. And then they can engage in various sorts of corruption activities. And Jackson increased the number of pet banks, but even he recognized this was a makeshift solution. So then once the Panic of 1837 came about, which really kind of once again reinvigorated the hard money forces even more, Van Buren decides, okay, now we're going to go for the independent treasury. We are going to have no pet banks, take all the money out of the banking system. The government's only going to keep, the federal government at least, is only going to keep their money in its own vaults and in specie. And this would no subsidies given to any banknotes, any bank deposits, any banking system, et cetera. And although the independent treasury was repealed a year later, after Van Buren lost his election in 1840, James K. Polk reinstates it, and it lasted for several decades. And even under the national banking system, it was a very efficient system. And this is something that your traditional histories don't go through. If anything, this is seen as an ignorant, just country bumpkin. Government's only going to accept hard money, gold and silver. But yeah, it was very good. It really did separate what the Jacksonians would call the separation of bank from state. They're clearly playing on the separation of church and state around this time, which they were also in favor of.
Now, did that last for about 20 years or so?
You're talking about the independent treasury system?
The independent treasury, yeah.
Yeah, so the independent treasury, it lasted, if you think of James K. Polk, it was in about 1846.
Oh, more like 15 years.
Yeah, 15. And now it still lasted after the national banking system, but then it became more of a nominal restriction. So it still did last. It still was somewhat effective, but with the national banking system, it was weaker. But that, even that 15 to 20 year period in the 1840s, 1850s, this is something various monetary historians have commented on. It was not this era of wildcat free banking and all sorts of fly by night operations. The actual losses to the banking system were fairly minor. And what losses did occur were caused by various government regulations, branch bank restrictions, requiring banks to back their notes, their bank notes with government bonds, state government bonds of dubious value more often than not, et cetera. But yeah, it did actually lead to a fairly stable monetary system. And this is something the Jacksonians need to be given credit for.
And we think about, I guess there was the Panic of 1857, but that was pretty mild. I mean, I think it might have been over in about 6 months. So it is an interesting system to be knowledgeable about because, as I say, you're not going to read about it in your textbook at all. Well, now let's back up now. Let's go back to when does it really, they're pushing for internal improvements really from the start, but it starts to pick up real steam, like real steam in probably the 1840s. Now in the 1820s, you have John Quincy Adams who favors internal improvements and a national university and stuff like that. What I want to talk about though is when most people hear about this, they think, well, that does make sense, doesn't it? I mean, you want to tie the country together and make transportation easier and more regular. So why wouldn't we want to spend money on canal building and roads and bridges or installations for, you know, ports or shipping or whatever? Wouldn't this be good for the economy? And aren't these the kinds of things private firms can't really do? They can't make a profit from. So of course we need to spend this money. And it's really a waste of everybody's time to be focused on the constitutional problem that it's not authorized in the Constitution. I mean, who cares? We obviously need this for the sake of having a robust economy. So is there any more to it than that? So in other words, it's innocent, wonderful people who are just advocating for something that is going to be of benefit to everybody versus backward, stupid idiots taking a magnifying glass to the Constitution and saying, I don't see roads in here. Is that the whole argument?
Yeah, so this is a very important debate in American history. You're going to the subject of internal improvements. Pro-government intervention, people would always push for it using the same arguments that are often used now. So you may have Henry Clay and his American system, which there are various similarities to that. And maybe let's just say build back better. You know, we're going to build back the country better. Now we're going to connect to the West with back then the West was the Mississippi River, basically. We're going to connect east to west, north to south, et cetera. And yeah, this is great. The government should build this or should at least embark upon these funds because the private sector clearly will underprovide this. And when the government will build various internal improvements, everything will turn out well, et cetera. The opponents of internal improvements, they're often criticized as, well, they're just strict constructionists using, again, an outdated theory, or even worse, it's all just a camouflage. They're worried about slavery. And if the government can start building roads, then they have the right to free slaves, et cetera. Those arguments were used from time to time. They weren't actually the main arguments motivating people. A lot of the states' rights and small government people, they realize that, well, the government embarks upon internal improvements. There's going to be corruption of various politicians. Businesses that are going to benefit from the construction contracts, et cetera, are also going to be lobbying. There will be various political considerations given. So when the government started to build the National Road, it was built along very long and winding routes because every little district in Pennsylvania and Maryland, et cetera, they wanted their own little slice of the pie, et cetera. And the government can't do it as well. And this was something that was really learned in the 1820s when states started to really embark upon their own internal improvements, that they didn't always turn out as their proponents envisioned. And combined with the growing resurgence of free market laissez-faire thought, a lot of people were saying, hey, well, why don't we actually just have the private sector do it, or maybe only have a very minimal amount of state involvement, right? And this was tied into the chartering system where banks and transportation companies, if they wanted to actually build a road or establish a bank, whatever, they had to appeal to the state legislature to get a charter. We started to realize that this was a very inefficient system, led to monopolies and cronyism, et cetera. And so that was tied in with the movement for general incorporation, which is that companies should just be able to basically file some minimal paperwork, et cetera, and they could decide whether or not they wanted to embark upon a particular transportation project and so on. And this was, there are, obviously, I believe in them. I think they're correct. But many people back then, they did have very sound economic reasons for why the government should not embark upon these projects. They were inefficient. It would lead to corruption. It would lead to endless government debt. All of these predictions that I think have turned out to be 100% correct.
Well, in terms of canal building, I'm pretty sure the Erie Canal is the only one that wound up not being a total fiasco financially. So there is that. But your book is called Cronyism. And when we hear things like roads and canals and whatever, I think most people genuinely do think of the general welfare. They don't think of this as cronyism. So what is this stuff doing in a book on cronyism?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Now, I do discuss the Erie Canal in my section on internal improvements in the 1820s. And I mentioned that, yeah, it was relatively successful. Part of this was due to the terrain. It was just very flat in New York, and there were a lot of lakes that could be used in construction of the canal, and various resources were also nearby and so on. But even then, it doesn't actually, it only covered its economic costs, wasn't actually that profitable. So the alternative investments, you know, that could have been used with those funds. And then, of course, the Erie Canal incentivized even more canal building in New York, which did not turn out to be profitable at all. And many of the Van Burenites did fight these canals, and for sound reasons. And soon enough, of course, the Erie Canal started to support crony regulations on railroads, various restrictions on the new railroad technology, saying that, oh, you couldn't ship goods on railroads during certain canal seasons, they have to pay extra money and all this stuff. And the Erie Canal, before long, was known as Clinton's Ditch, right? You think of the Governor DeWitt Clinton had really pushed for the canal, and given enough time, it was just a ditch. So it's like most government internal improvements. But, you know, the cronyism, it is actually very important to discuss internal improvements because it was related to a tremendous amount of special privileges. Internal improvements in general, at least at the federal level, these were linked in with Henry Clay's American system. The idea that, well, we need to support a central bank to provide cheap credit to businesses. We need to support a protective tariff to protect northern industry. And then land sales, so having high prices of land out west, combined with tariff revenue, we can build all sorts of internal improvements to consolidate the government, to pay all sorts of companies to build things or to build them on our own, and et cetera. And this did lead to a lot of cronyism, right? Because once again, these government enterprises, they were built very inefficiently. They were built along very winding routes. The Pennsylvania tried to mimic the Erie Canal with its mainline canal, even though a railroad would have been more technologically feasible given Pennsylvania's hilly terrain, et cetera. Various promoters of the project, such as Nicholas Biddle, who was the head of the Second Bank of the United States, said we need to push forward and continue on with this. And it really only led to benefits for wealthy Philadelphia Eastern merchants in the east of the state as opposed to the rest of the state. And you can go on with various examples that I provide in my book, whether the National Road in the 1810s, various state-level internal improvements in the 1820s, and then in the 1830s. These projects were classic government boondoggles in that they often benefited just the people involved in the actual production. They would overcharge for materials, right, and benefit, pocket the money. This was, of course, employed the most in the building of the transcontinental railroads during the Civil War, a tremendous amount of graft and so on. But yeah, it was really, and it's the same thing we think of now when you think about government infrastructure. They're not built efficiently. They're going to benefit the construction companies and the various politicians that are connected, involved in the projects. And it really is something that I think your average person needs to recognize that, hey, maybe the government shouldn't build the roads, right? We always think, well, who's going to build the roads or who's going to build the schools, et cetera? And the answer should obviously be that, you know, the private sector, or at the very least, just more on the state level, state and local level.
We're just about at half an hour, so let me have you do a little summary then of one other issue that comes up in a discussion of 19th century cronyism, and that would be tariffs and trade. Because the way we think about tariffs these days has changed a bit, I would say, in the past 30 years. People are more likely to think, well, policymakers are more likely to think tariffs are bad. But a lot of people in the general public are likely to think that tariffs can help workers and they can help the average person. So how are they being portrayed in the 19th century? What do you think the reality was?
So the reality is, in a sense, many of the same arguments that you hear today, oh, tariffs will protect industry and so on, or we need them for national defense reasons, et cetera. And many Americans back then did hold that view, or, well, especially those connected with manufacturing and so on. Well, you need to have the government protect various industry. But there also were many other Americans, such as the Jeffersonians and Jacksonians, Southerners, as well as many in the North involved in the mercantile business, who recognized that tariffs were a special privilege, right? That they protected the industries that benefited from blocking out foreign competition at the expense of the industries that had to pay higher prices, as well as the consumers. So they were elements of government privilege. The Jacksonians did attack them on these grounds, explicitly using the rhetoric of government privilege and government favoritism, et cetera. And they really were protective and they were regressive. And when you look at, for instances of cronyism, protective tariffs back then, they were notorious examples of government cronyism where you're getting various businesses lobbying for special privileges, et cetera. In my book, I trace the lobbying of the government by really one of the first organized special interest groups in the United States, which were the Boston Associates. So these manufacturers that were in Boston and in surrounding areas in Massachusetts and New England, and they had started to embark upon textile production, so building, you know, clothing, et cetera, developing these massive factories and so on. And part of that undeniably is the capitalist impetus, et cetera. But a lot of it was they were benefiting from protective tariffs. And they would even push for what was known as a minimum valuation on goods, so on cheap cloth, which would be extremely regressive. It's basically pricing very cheap cloth at a much higher price, or assessing it at a higher price, so a tariff would be higher. So, for example, initially they were pushing for a 25-cent minimum valuation on cotton textiles. So that means that a cotton shirt priced at 9 cents would be assessed, the tariff on it would be assessed as if the price was 25 cents. So there's a 33% tariff. Instead of having a 3-cent tariff on a 9-cent cotton cloth, there would be basically an 8.5-cent tariff on the 9-cent cloth, which was a whopping tariff rate of 93%. So that's enormously regressive. I trace the companies that lobbied for this, so the Boston Associates, as well as their Boston Manufacturing Company, et cetera. And this continued throughout the 1820s and the 1830s, when there were various protective rates, such as the Tariff of 1824 or the Tariff of Abominations, that did benefit entrenched manufacturing interests. And this was something that the Jacksonians genuinely fought, and they were successful at removing through the Walker Tariff of 1846, but only through the help of Great Britain also lowering its tariffs, right? So it's a sort of a reciprocal movement towards free trade. Tariffs were big issues back then, and they were, of course, very big areas of corruption.
Wow, I love hearing a young whippersnapper rattle off stuff like that. Well, you know, you sounded like, what's the name of that guy who wrote the tariff history?
Frank Taussig, right?
Taussig, that's right. The tariff history in the 19th century of history of the United States. And I thought, geez, it's like I'm listening to him. it's been so long since I pored over this stuff.
Yeah.
That I'm glad you're out there doing it. Well, of course, there's still so much more because there's so much darn corruption to cover. You know, how could we do it justice in a couple of podcast episodes? So if you want more, you're going to have to go out and get the book, which once again is Cronyism, Liberty versus Power in America, 1607 to 1849 by our guest, Patrick Newman. You can find a link to that book at tomwoods.com/2013. And happy Thanksgiving to you, Patrick. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to talk about the book. Happy Thanksgiving to you too.
All right, folks, I hope you all have a great Thanksgiving. Don't forget about the Black Friday special at libertyclassroom.com, where you learn the history and economics they didn't teach you. Head over to libertyclassroom.com, Black Friday weekend, and you'll get the best deal we have on the lifetime membership. So check that baby out. And also remember, if you're interested in learning a foreign language, thinking ahead to when we're no longer imprisoned in our countries, you can look ahead to the day when you're speaking a brand new language, or a language that's brand new to you anyway, to some folks in some other country. And you can learn that language through Rocket Languages, a company whose founders I know personally and who put out a really, really good product in a variety of languages. And they're having their annual Black Friday deal, and it's 60% off everything. So put that on your calendar to remember to go take advantage of that on Black Friday. So, in fact, I think it may be running this whole week until Black Friday. So check that out, tomwoods.com/rocket, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.